you wouldn't mind, we'll call the meeting to order, and if you would please, we'll roll call.
All right. Member Talley.
Here.
Member Hageman.
Here.
Member Gibson.
Here.
Member Barnich.
Here.
Member Bright.
Here.
Member Guthrie.
Here.
All right.
Excellent. So then at this time, we'll call for public comment, an opportunity for members of the public to address the committee on items that are not on the agenda. Do we have any public comment?
There is no public comment in terms of chat from my end.
All right, then. I guess we'll move on then to the approval of the meeting minutes of July 16th, 2020. The regular meeting.
I move approval of the minutes.
Okay, so there are no changes or additions from anyone?
No.
Okay. Hearing none then. So we have a motion.
Aye.
I'll second that, Director Gibson.
All right. Who motioned?
Brian.
Okay.
We have a motion and a second. So do we want to do this I can't remember how we did this the last time. Is this a roll call or?
Well, because we're doing this and we can't all see each other, the best course of action is just to do the roll call vote each time.
All right. So if we can then do a roll call on this, please.
All right. See, Member Bright?
Yes.
Member Talley?
Yes.
Member Hageman?
Yes.
Member Gibson?
Yes.
Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Member Barnich?
Yes.
Right, motion passes.
Very good. All right, then, moving along here to the operations report. We'll start with water plant operations, reservoir storage, and downstream releases, please.
Yes. Today we have Jenny Williamson, who works at the water treatment plant here, and she will she'll read out what today's operations numbers are.
Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. So tonight, numbers are as follows. For the lake elevation, it's at 484.84. Storage is at 22,150 acre feet. Capacity is currently at 45%. Rainfall to date is at 0.06 inches. Plant production is at 4.85 MGD. State water production is at 0.70 MGD. And downstream releases are at 2.2 MGD.
Are there any questions on that?
No questions? Okay, well, thank you very kindly. So I guess then we'll move on to the projected reservoir levels.
Yes. In your packet, it's attachment 2. And those of you who are following along on the web, you should be able to see it here on your screen. What you see is the point of interest is about where my hand, where the little hand is, and that's where the green line, the yellow line, and the red line meet. The yellow line, that's the green, that point is where we're at today. The yellow designates if we get no rain, you can see that we will get down to close to 20,000 acre feet somewhere around December. If we get some of the projected rainfall, numbers may come up slightly, but I would kind of doubt that we would see that kind of an increase only because the first rains of the season mostly go into the soil and they do not become runoff. We usually don't see runoff until later on in the year. And we've been noticing that this chart that we've been using in terms of what the anticipated rainfall is not accurate. In fact, they don't even update their numbers. So we're currently on the hunt for more accurate rainfall prediction, you know, rainfall monthly predictions. So more to come on that. I will point out something kind of interesting. I didn't notice it, but the staff member who produces this report, she said, did you notice that, and I'll show you here on the screen, that if you go over by 12/1/2018, it says that the predicted rainfall is, let's see, it's the same number every year. Like if you look at 12/1/2018, it says in blue, it says 1.7. If you look at 12/1/2019, it says 1.7. So the numbers are all exactly the same. So that was our first clue that we need to look for some new data. So just be aware that we'll be working on this chart over the next couple months. So. Anybody have any questions on the projected surge for the reservoir?
Doesn't sound like it. Okay, well, thank you for that. So then we'll move on now to the July and August monthly operations report, please.
Yes, attachment 3 in your packet. excuse me, the July. your July report there is about, this is typical for this time of year in terms of the overall usage, which can be found on the far right part of the table, 550.41 acre feet. That's sort of a normal for this time of year. Nothing exceptional to report on this. All the agencies are still using their entitlement. And you can see that over here under the category, it says this month entitlement. And when you see surplus, there's zero surplus usage. That means everybody's still using entitlement, and that's normal as well. So I don't have anything special about this one. We are at 1,459 acre feet of stored state water. And then if you move on to your second page of attachment 3, which is the August 2020, you can see now we're even higher. This is probably our highest month usage, August and September. We're at 583. Our state water number is going down slightly, and that's because because Pismo Beach and Oceano are both are taking some state water, although Oceano has just informed us that they are not going to be taking any state water for the rest of the year. So Pismo will be the only one taking state water. It's probably the only notable things here. And are there any questions on the operations report?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the information.
All right.
Okay. So we'll move on now then to our informational items, starting with A, cloud seeding final report.
Online right here, I have, we have Garrett. I'm going to unshare my screen for a moment. We have Garrett Cammons from our North American Weather Consultants, I believe. And they gave a similar presentation to the TAC, and I found it to be really interesting. So I thought that you all might enjoy as well hearing kind of their summary of what our last rain season looked like from a cloud seeding standpoint.
Hey, I'm sorry. I'm back on now. When I went to click on the tab to to adjust my audio, I accidentally exited the tab, so I'm back.
That's all right. We've all been there, done that, with all this stuff, so no worries.
Okay. How are you all doing tonight?
Great.
Good.
Good. Well, I'm excited to be with you all. As Jill said, we ran the cloud seeding program for you guys this past season, and we're just getting ready to get everything up and running for this season. So I've got a presentation to go through some of the results and how the program went, what operations look like. But I thought it might be helpful for us to step back really quick and just speak on some of the generals of what cloud seeding is and how it works, if you all think that would be helpful. Jill, if you wouldn't mind sharing.
I'll make you the presenter.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, here you go.
Okay, let's enlarge this a bit.
Good.
So cloud seeding, it sounds a little sci-fi, I understand that, but it's actually just very basic chemistry. And there's a couple things that are involved. So the first aspect of cloud seeding is that there has to be a cloud. So there needs to be a storm, there needs to be a cloud, there needs to be moisture in the air. Now, when a storm rolls through, something that a lot of us probably don't or wouldn't guess is that water in the clouds is often well below freezing. In fact, liquid water that's pure doesn't instantaneously freeze until it's negative 30 degrees, which goes a little bit against what you may have learned in high school. But super cooled water can last and persist in a storm for a long period of time unless there's a contaminant or something for that water to coalesce and attach to. And at that point, it freezes and becomes a hailstone or a snowflake. So when these storms come in off the coast and they carry all this moisture in, there's a lot of water that's staying floating up in the air that's not freezing and that's not falling. And what cloud seeding does is it instigates a freezing process that causes that water to collect and to fall. So on this picture here, we have storm winds that are blowing up over a mountain. They pick up silver iodide particles and they carry those silver iodide particles up into the cloud system. Alternatively, we can disperse those with the plane directly into the cloud. That silver iodide then becomes a surface area that instigates that freezing process. As the water freezes, it collects, it aggregates, and then it falls down and it becomes runoff or snowpack depending on the area of operation. For San Luis Obispo County, we're looking for a pretty much immediate runoff. So that's the basic mechanism at play when we're operating a cloud seeding program. Are there any questions from the body on how that works or what some of those principles look like?
No.
No questions? Okay, we'll keep going. Just really quickly, I'll show you one more slide, and this gets a little bit more into the chemistry of what we're doing. We'll keep this pretty light, though. The reason that silver iodide works is twofold. Silver iodide is a very polarized molecule. So like water, it's got a very positive charge side and a very negatively charged side. And that helps to attract these water molecules that are just floating in the air that wouldn't fall on their own. The other aspect is that the molecular structure for silver iodide is very similar to that of ice. So it's shaped like ice. It's charged like ice and therefore becomes a very good surface for water to join to. So that's how it works. We're just taking a natural process and we're making it more efficient. So we get a little bit more rainfall and a little bit more water in our reservoirs. We'll talk about the results as we get a little bit further and how we calculate and tabulate those results. But let's go ahead and we'll switch into operations. So let me switch screens here. And we'll discuss how the operations went this year. So this is a map. There's a few things on here. This is outlined in yellow is our target area. So this is the watershed that we were targeting. Oh, sorry, is there a question there? Just a little feedback, okay. The plane, this plane image, this is in Santa Maria. So the plane that we flew was located at the Santa Maria Airport. And then these two red dots.
Can, let me interrupt real quick. Can everybody mute your microphone? That should include me. I will do that as well. If everyone could mute their microphone, we will be in good shape.
Okay, perfect. There we go. So these two red dots, these represent locations that we did ground seeding from. So we had the plane flying out of Santa Maria, and we had ground-based operations at Burroughs Peak and Mount Losby. These are actually ground-based locations that were originally set up to seed for Santa Barbara, but under certain wind regimes and certain wind patterns, they actually make very effective seeding sources for your watershed as well. So now as we look at operations, NOC was contracted for the cloud season through April 15th. We started mid-January. We were hoping to have an early January start date, but it took a little bit more time for the contracts and everything to come through. So we started mid-January. We had an aircraft and pilot located in Santa Maria, as I said before. Now, unfortunately, January and February proved to be some of the driest months ever experienced on the Central Coast, which really kind of hampered our seeding opportunities for those months. March and April got significantly better, which was good. So as we take a look at where you were at precip-wise for January and February, 15% of normal in January and 0 to 1% of normal in February. Obviously, there was no rain. So very dry. So no operations could occur during those 2 months or during that 2 month period. We did have one storm on the 16th that I should mention. So there was a storm that moved in very rapidly. It wasn't a really high producing storm, but it was a storm. As our pilot got the plane onto the runway, the storm blew in so quickly, visibility was so minimal that for safety reasons, he was unable to fly the plane. And then that storm moved forward, moved out of the area pretty quickly. So in March and April, things got better. So as we look at the percents of normal in March and April, we're actually above average in both months, pretty significantly come April. So these were months that provided a lot of great seeding opportunity. So we had 4 operational days in March and 2 in April. Of those 6 operational days, we used the aircraft on 1, and we used our ground-based operations for 5 of those days. And local streams started to respond pretty early, with some runoff occurring in mid-March and a dramatic increase in runoff occurring at the beginning of April. So for operations, these are the dates that we operated on. We operated on March 9th and 10th, and again on the 16th, 22nd, and then April 5th and 6th. Now, for March 9th and 10th, there were kind of back-to-back storm periods. We chose to fly during the larger of the storm events, so we flew on March 10th, and we seeded from 1 o'clock to 1:45. The plane was in the air much longer than that, but that was the period at which it was deemed ideal for seeding, and then we used ground-based operations for the rest of these storm sequences. I'll go ahead and break here again if there's any questions thus far on our operations before I move on.
I have a question. We had, and I can't remember which month it was, but we had one storm that was predicted to, like, drop a ton of inches in a very short amount of time, and I don't remember all the details. Do you, when you have a significant storm like that, does seeding still take place?
Yeah, that's a great question, and the answer is a little bit mixed. So we have minimum seeding thresholds. So the storm has to be forecasted to produce a minimum amount of rain. And then we also have suspension criteria where we consider ceasing operations if flooding is likely. Now, on that upper end, there's a lot of factors that come into play. So we want to understand the intensity of the rain. We want to understand the location where the highest intensity rainfall is likely to occur. We need to understand the state of infrastructure. So there's a number of variables that we look at during those high intensity storms. And those are time periods where there were a couple storms in particular where we worked pretty closely with Jill and her team to understand the potential risks of flooding and making to make sure that we weren't operating in a situation where flooding would be inevitable. One of the things that Jill brought to our attention, particularly with Slo County, is that early storms can induce more flooding if the sandbar hasn't been fully pushed out yet. So we were a little bit more cautious in those first couple storms, and then there was a little bit more liberty in some of the later storms in the season. So there's just a lot of things that we have our eye on and we pay close attention to make sure that we're not adding to a flood scenario.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Great question, by the way.
Hi, this is Brian Talley. Why wasn't there more aircraft seating later in the season?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's one that I wanted to make sure we addressed. So there's a few reasons for that. One is going back to that threshold question that we had. Aircraft seating is significantly more expensive than ground-based seating. So we're a little bit more particular about the thresholds with the storm, particularly the minimum threshold. So the storm's got to be forecasted to produce more rain for aircraft to be considered viable than for ground to be considered viable. The second part of that question is there was actually, within NOC, we had our pilot passed away at the beginning of March from a heart attack. And so we were using a pilot from Fresno to fly for us. And and he's very experienced. He's flown for us for many years. But when it comes to a flight and a storm period, the pilot has discretion about whether or not conditions are deemed safe to fly. And one of the things that we ran into consistently in Santa Barbara was a strong occurrence of lightning and thunder that prevented our pilot from feeling comfortable getting up in the air. The pilot that passed away was a lot more confident flying in those types of situations, to be honest. The other pilot that we were using from Fresno did not feel as comfortable flying in those. And again, when it comes to flight safety, the pilot has to have the final say. So fortunately, we had this network of ground-based generators that provide ample seating opportunity or great seating opportunity for those seasons. There were financial and fiscal credits that were applied nonetheless for the lack of a dedicated pilot and some other things that we're doing this season to help with the establishment of a larger ground network for seating as well. And these are some of the reasons or some of the things that Jill and I have talked about as we've talked preparation for this season, where it's looking like we're going to move to a ground-only program because it alleviates a lot of those variables that are outside of our control, namely safety, visibility, extended or accentuating expense, and it makes cloud seeding in nearly every storm situation a lot more feasible.
This is Shirley. I have a simple question. Can you explain the ground seeding process?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I had a couple slides here. Let me skip ahead to those and we can come back. So when we fly, the plane that we had stationed in Santa Barbara had a flare rack like this in this picture here, where there's flares with silver iodide and they burn as the pilot flies. Now these don't explode off the wings like a firecracker, they just burn in place. On the ground, we use the exact same flares and we have these flare racks that these flares are installed in, and we can remotely control when these flares ignite. So as the storm comes in, we'll ignite these flares and they'll burn in place and they'll release silver iodide that's then carried up into the storm system by updrafts created through convection. And so these burn-in-place flares, fire, fume, and then that silver iodide is transported up into the storm system.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you for the question. Any follow-up? Perfect.
Sorry, one more question. My dogs are going to bark right when I unmute myself.
That's okay.
So since we're looking like we're going to go ground only and not from the air in the future, which I understand the things we can't control, so I understand, what are we giving up? Is it that you sometimes get more, success from the air than you do from the ground?
Yeah, that's a great question. And let me pull up the different slide deck here and go through that concept with you. Actually, let's go back to this original image that I showed. So there are some advantages of air. Silver iodide is effective once it gets into the storm system and it reaches that super cooled liquid water that I discussed earlier. When a plane flies through the storm system, those flares are burning right at that level where the water is on the verge of freezing. So we can fly right into the storm and we can just kind of drop the silver iodide right where we'd like it. So that's an advantage of air. Now, there are a few disadvantages of air as well. Limitations that are outside of our control, like I mentioned before, so conditions, safety conditions, the airworthiness of the plane if there's a mechanical issue and it stalls the flight. But the biggest limitation with the plane is that it's a single point source. So it's only dispersing silver iodide at any given time from one point, and that's wherever the plane is located. Now, the plane will fly back and forth as fast as it can, but it's still limited in speed, so you're limited in coverage. Ground generators, we can set up a network, so you're getting silver iodide released from multiple locations simultaneously and continuously across the storm front. So we can be launching flares from more locations. Now, we are dependent on wind carrying the silver iodide up into the storm. So in certain areas, this could be a very limiting factor, a restricting factor. Now, what we found through over 50 years of research in Santa Barbara, just adjacent to you guys, is that the storm types that occur when cold, moist air moves inland and meets warm, dry air is that there's a significant amount of wind activity and updraft that is a very effective transportation method for the silver iodide. So our research in Santa Barbara has shown that because of that updraft, we get incredibly efficient carry of these silver iodide particles up into the storm system, alleviating one of the biggest potential down or concerns with ground-based seeding. So we neutralize the negative consequence of being on the ground with those particular storm and wind patterns that are common in your area, while adding the benefits of having a more robust network, more locations of release, lower thresholds, and more consistency. And then on top of all of that, the cost of running and operating a ground-based program is about 30% less than running or maintaining a program with a plane. So the benefits are very, very overwhelming, and the cost is significantly less. So overall, we feel like it's a good method for your particular climate and your particular geography. Now, if we were seeding in Texas on flat plains with very little updraft, that would not be the case. We would have to do it by air. But on the coast with good land barriers and a lot of updraft, ground-based seeding is a very effective method.
Okay, thank you very much. That information was super helpful. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually,
any other follow-up question?
Then is there a plan to add more of the ground-based stations?
Yes, there is a plan to add more ground-based stations. Let me pull up. I was actually working on that before this call, getting some information together for Jill. So let me pull up a map here. Sorry, I'm just getting this ready. So we're looking at a site in Aurora Grande as a possible AHOG site, and the documentation that I was putting together is for the permitting process. So we've got this water tank here, and we're looking at installing it just to the southeast of that tank up on this hill. And this would provide excellent coverage in southwesterly flow. So any storms that are coming from the southwest, and then also some westerly flow as well. But most of the storms that carry good moisture come in with a southerly component. So the storms coming from the southwest, so winds are southwesterly, moving up and over the watershed here. So this is one location that we're looking at. The city of Aurora Grande has already mentioned some interest in partnering on this. And then we're also, if possible, trying to find a location a little bit further north for storms that only carry a westerly component. So for storms coming in from a due west direction. Those are less common and they typically carry less moisture. So they're not as critical to the program, but we'd still like to have that additional coverage if possible. And then we've worked out with Santa Barbara a timeshare split on the Burroughs Peak site so that we can continue to use that site as well. So we'll have at least two operational sites and hopefully a third.
Okay, this is Kristen Varnish from a city council member and AG. I'm not able to see what you're showing all of us. So can you just give me an idea of where the site in Aurora Grande is, like a street or some sort of a landmark so that I can make a note?
Yeah, so it's on city property, and Jill can correct me. We've got the parcel number that we can send you, but there is a large water tank. And it's on the southern side of AG, right above the 101. So off of Branch Street, it looks like, and the 101.
Kristen, okay, it's up by Milt Hayes.
Oh, okay. I know. Small town. I know exactly where it is. Thank you.
Beautiful town, by the way. Really pretty. This
okay,
is great.
Sorry,
any
one more question. I'm sorry. Can you tell me, since we're done with the first season, can someone tell me, and I, if you don't have the information offhand, someone can send it to me later, what the season ended up costing?
Yeah, it was, I think it was right around $180,000. Jill, looks like you're looking that up.
Yeah, that's approximately correct. I don't have it right in front of me, but yeah, that's about what it was. Christy, our finance person, is here.
Hi. Yes, Christy Smith, finance. It looks like it was around $160,000 for the program last year.
Okay, thanks, Christy.
You're welcome.
And last year we ran, it was about a 3-month program. This year the proposal is for a 4.5-month program with a possible 2-week extension if the weather looks favorable. And running a ground program for 5 months will be roughly the same cost as running that aerial program for 3 months. We get a lot better coverage. We have a lot more opportunity to seed storms. So there's a lot of benefits that will come along with that. Okay, any other questions? Okay, we'll go back to the slide deck. Let's see where we were at here. I'll skip through some of this. So this, if you're interested, when we did fly, this was the flight track. So it took off in Santa Maria and then did some back and forth trails just outside of Santa Maria. Let's talk a little bit about the weather, and we've touched on this already as I've described why ground seeding is so effective for this area. But I've got some satellite imagery here of some storms that have come in over the area, and then I've also got this kind of animated picture here, this cartoon image of how these coastal storms work. there's a very particular weather pattern that is often seen on the central coastline, and we refer to that as a convective band. And so we have a very linear band of moisture that comes in off the ocean. Convective refers to how the band is created or how the storm originates. And as I mentioned earlier, you've got cool, moist ocean air that meets warmer, drier air that's inland. And that warm, dry air is forced upwards as that cold front comes in. And as you get that updraft, you get mixing, convection. So you get all this mixing that builds the structure of the clouds, carries the moisture, and creates very turbulent, very storm-rich, or creates a very storm-rich environment. So lots of rain, lots of thunder and lightning, potentially, oftentimes hail and other things. So that's the basis of the storm structures that we see so frequently here in Santa Barbara, as San Luis Obispo, both. And as I mentioned earlier, this is why ground seeding is so effective. We've already gone through all of this, so we'll skip ahead. The last thing I wanted to discuss today is how we evaluate these programs to make sure that there is a return and an adequate return for the client on the from the program itself. And what we've done is we've developed over the last 50, 60 years, a number of mathematical models to help us understand what's occurring compared to what should occur. So let me go ahead and switch screens here again. And as long as there's interest, I'm assuming, in understanding our evaluation process. Okay, we'll go ahead. Let me switch screens. And if you'd like me to, if you have any questions, you can interrupt me as I go through this. That's fine. This can be a little bit complicated. So our evaluation process begins with the identification of what we refer to as target and control locations. So in this map here, the control, this evaluation was done for Santa Barbara. We were not able to receive all of the data due to COVID for the San Luis Obispo area this season. We will eventually receive that data and perform an evaluation specifically for your program. But we performed a multi-year evaluation for Santa Barbara in 2015. Since you're just adjacent to each other, you're benefiting from the same storms, we're using a lot of the same technology and methodology, this is a really good comparison to your watershed. So in developing this evaluation for 2015, we identified areas that were not going to benefit from seeding. So these are our control sites, and they're located in green. And then we identified areas that would benefit from seeding. So areas inside our target areas. So those are the target sites identified here in red. So we've got control locations and then target locations. And what we do is we develop a relationship by looking at historic records between these target and control locations. And then we plot that data. So this will be look a little convoluted, but I'll explain. So this is rainfall for the control area where no seeding will ever occur. And this is rainfall for the target area where during certain years, seeding will occur. And we plot that data. And this data helps us understand a probability relationship between rainfall in the target area versus rainfall in the control area. Now, here we've created a double mass plot where we've plotted for seeded years and for non-seeded years. And you'll notice the relationship where for the seeded years, there was substantially more rainfall in the target area versus the non-seeded years in blue. So we see that on average, the target area shows substantially higher precip in seeded years compared to the control area than during non-seeded years. So I'll go ahead and pause here for questions.
Would you repeat that one more time?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's go ahead and we'll go back to the map and I'll go through this again a little bit quicker, but we'll go through it all from the beginning. So what we did was we identified areas that would never be seeded. So they're downwind from any of our seeding equipment and any of our flares. So So those locations are identified in green here on the map. Then we identify areas of measure inside the target area, and those locations are identified here in red. Now, in reality, we look at multiple variables inside the target area. We look at stream flow, precip, and other gauges. But the relationship that we develop is the same. So we've got control areas, no seeding, target areas, seeding. Now we look at historic records and we pull data from years when no seeding occurred in either location and years where seeding occurred in just a target location. And we plot that data on this chart here. And the blue dots show us how much rain occurred in the target area versus the control area when there was no seeding that occurred in either. The red dot reflects the precipitation that occurred in the target area when there was seeding compared to the precip that appeared in the control area. And what we see is that on average, in those seeded years, the target area precip was well above, in comparison to the control area, that, During years where there was seeding, the target area showed significantly higher average precip in comparison to the control site's precip than in years where no seeding occurred.
Got it. Thank you.
Garrett?
Yeah.
One question comes to mind is those of us who live here might question why was Paso Robles chosen as a control location, as a control up there? Yeah, Paso Robles, that. There's a mountain range between that doesn't seem like, I'm curious on how you determine a control spot, because you could have picked a control spot like the Carrizo Plains that gets virtually no rain, and it would seem that then your target versus control would look really great.
Yeah, so the target versus control, that's a great question. These control sites were picked based off of a number of attributes. We tried to find control sites that showed similar climatological histories. Now, that doesn't mean that the rainfall has to be the same, and I'll explain why in a minute, but similar patterns of rainfall, similar geographics as much as possible. Now, we evaluated a number of different contenders for these control sites that were eventually selected. So there's a number of different sites that we'll look at and that we'll evaluate. And there's actually two studies that we did, and I'll show different control sites and different target sites for the second study. But in essence, what we're looking at is not that these two sites have to have the same amount of precip, but that the precip is generally related. So it's predictable. If you get 3 inches of rain here, you'll consistently get 2 inches of rain here. So the rainfall amounts don't have to be the same as long as that pattern and that predictability is strong. So between these sites, normally when we look for a control site, we run a regression, which is a mathematical way of evaluating the statistical significance between a relationship across two different variables. And we're looking for an R value greater than 0.85. So we're looking at for like a 90% to 95% confidence in the relationship. So we do evaluate the confidence interval. We do look for multiple contenders for the control sites. And then we choose from those possibles based off of the strongest mathematical relationship.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
From the standpoint of timing, Garrett, we have a few more minutes to give to this, and then we'll have to.
Perfect. And I think we're almost done, and I can skip ahead on a lot of this too. Real quickly, this is for one of our Utah programs, and this kind of summarizes what we're looking for in a lot more simplistic way than the double mass plots I showed before. This is a line that represents the relationship between precip and a control area and a target area. This point right here is where we began to seed. So you can see how predictable that relationship was up until 1976. And then you can see what happened to the slope of that line after 1976. So there's this inflection point that correlates perfectly with the start date of our seeding program in this particular area. So again, there's a given relationship and a pretty clearly defined relationship between the control area and the target area. Once seeding occurs, there's a definitive adjustment to that relationship, and we see substantially more rainfall or a steeper slope in the target area versus the control area. So this type of modeling, this is what we look for in all of our areas, and we operate in Utah, Colorado, and California with numerous programs in all three of those states that have all seen very similar results. Now, if we look at the actual measurements and the actual results, based off of the target area that we were evaluating, we saw between a 9 and 21% increase in rainfall across the Santa Barbara targets for the multi-year period that we assessed the increase. So we're looking at between 10 and 20% increase in rainfall, which over the season works out to be fairly substantial. Based off of these models, for most of our California programs, we're producing water at a rate of between $30 and $130 an acre foot, just depending on the size of the target area and the size of the watershed. And with that, with the last couple minutes, Jill, we'll just turn it over if anybody has any follow-up questions on any of the topics that we've discussed today. Okay. Jill, if we didn't send this presentation to you already, I'll send it to you now. You feel free to forward it to anybody in the group. And then if there's additional questions that come up after the meeting, just send them to me and we can address them individually or in a follow-up discussion.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you, Garrett. Thanks for your time tonight. I realize that it's an hour later for you than it is here. So thank you for participating late tonight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then just stop sharing.
Yep.
All right.
Then do I need to give control back to you?
Nope, I've got it.
You got it?
Let's see. I do.
Okay. And thanks, everybody. Thanks for your questions. I don't remember if it was Brian or Brad, and Karen, I think, asked a lot of questions, so I really appreciate that. And please let Jill know if you have any other follow-up questions after this discussion. We really want to be transparent and want to be involved as much as possible, so don't hesitate to send your questions. We'll make sure to get back to them quickly.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Garrett.
Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. We'll talk to you later.
Let's see. So, Karen.
Yes, okay. So, I believe now we're going to move on to 5B, the fourth quarter budget status. I think Christy Smith.
Yep. Good yes. evening. Yes. Hi. Christy Smith, County Public Works Finance. So the fourth quarter budget status report for fiscal year 19-20. The report covers the period July 1st, 2019 to June 30th, 2020. At the end of the fiscal year, total expenses were 70% of the annual budget, leaving a balance of approximately $1.7 million. Of that balance, approximately $1.5 million will be carried over into fiscal year 2020-2021 for ongoing efforts and projects. So attachment 4 in your packets includes three graphs that illustrate the budget versus the actual expenses. There it goes. The first graph displays routine O&M. Expenses were 96% of the budget, resulting in a savings of approximately $164,000. The second graph displays non-routine O&M, and expenses were 30% of the budget. Just under $600,000 will be carried forward into fiscal year 2021. Most of it is for the HCP effort and the cloud seeding program, which we just talked about. An approximate savings of $10,000 will be credited back to the agencies. The third graph displays capital outlay. Expenses were 4% of the budget. Almost $920,000 will be carried forward into fiscal year 2021 to continue the projects. An approximate savings of $69,000 will be credited back to the agencies. So all agencies are current on their payments, and the estimated credits for fiscal year 19-20 total a little more than $240,000. They'll be allocated to the agencies and mailed along with the second installment of the fiscal year 2021 billings that are due January 1st. That concludes my report. Any questions?
Do you have any questions? No?
This is Brad, and I guess just have to maybe Jill can offer some explanation, I guess, in terms of capital programs or capital project, 4% of budget. I guess the good news and bad news, we didn't spend very much of the budget, rolled a lot over, but at the same time, we didn't spend very much of the budget. So what are the ramifications or discussion regarding that?
Yeah, I can answer a little bit. I've enlarged it on the screen for you, but if you have it, you can see that the spillway physical investigation, we budgeted $200,000 and we spent all, we're still waiting to find out if DSOD has approved our next step on what we think we should do in terms of physical investigation. So that was $200,000 that wasn't spent. You can see the $180,000 from the repair fault zone on the left dam abutment that we decided to put that a little bit on the back burner because we wanted to actually do a risk assessment to find out, you know, how risky is it if we kind of do nothing on it. So that's, and we were unable to do the, we just haven't had the staff resources to instigate a consultant to do a risk assessment of that particular problem. The other thing, equipment storage, garage design, we spent some money, but a majority of that work was not done either. And a lot of this is in part because I have not had staff to put towards zone 3 efforts. And that is because the zone 11A, waterway management plan down there at the bottom, at the lower end of Arroyo Grande Creek in the managed channel, took an entire staff member away over a year ago from my team. And that was David Spiegel. And he is the one that usually, he would be the one that would be furthering most of these projects. Because there was a lot of grant funding involved in that zone 11A, the utilities division manager and the rest of the department deemed that that was the highest priority for our division. So we gave up David Spiegel for a while. So that's a large part of why a lot of these projects didn't move forward. The fire flow tank repair, I will say that the domestic tank repair, that's completed. It actually came in way under budget. And so that you can see over in the far column, it says that there's $10,000 available. That will actually get rolled into the fire flow tank repair. And the fire flow tank repair is probably something on the order of $600,000 to $800,000 to, you know, replace it. So we are currently just trying to save up money towards that project. So that's another, you know, $85,000 that we did not spend, and that was purposeful. I mean, we're next year we're going to budget, I think it was $100,000. Christy can remind me, it's in this budget, but we have basically, we're going to try to accumulate, you know, somewhere on the order of $600,000 to $800,000 over the next 2 to 3 years so that we can pursue that project. So that's some of the big ticket items why it looks like we didn't do anything. And it's kind of a twofold. One, some projects were put on hold because I don't have staff, which when, as we get closer in the budget this next year, you know, my recommendation is that the contractors consider potentially upping up upping our labor that we put towards zone three in the form of, you know, requesting a dedicated, you know, engineer three to work on basically nothing but zone three. If we really want to move some of these projects forward at a faster pace. So that'll be up for consideration. But that's kind of the explanation, Brad. Is that good?
Yeah. I think, and just the follow-up is there, you kind of hit on it there. Is there something we can do to help with that? I don't know if we get Dave back or not sometime this year or after the calendar year. But I was aware that there was some staffing issues. And I think it's a great point about the fire flow tank that we're going to, you know, pile up. We're kind of purposely going to pile up some dough for that. So
yes.
Appreciate that.
Jill? Yes. So you said that there is one other item on here that is completed. I only see note that one is completed. Is there another one on here?
The domestic tank repair, that's the third one from the bottom. It had a budget of $15,000, and we were actually able to do all the repairs for $4,300. So we actually have a savings of $10,000. That one was completed.
Okay. So two of these items are complete on this list.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions regarding this item? Nope. Okay. All right then. So thank you very much for that information. So we'll now move along to item six. Capital projects update, bi-monthly update. David Spiegel.
Thank you, Karen. So in your packet, if you're following along, we're on attachment five. Again, this is the zone three capital projects update, which we basically just touched on in review of last year. So you'll see the spillway assessment. I wrote no change because this is since July when I presented this, there has been no change on the status of this project. So spillway assessment, no change. As you recall, we came to regarding the structural assessment of the terminal reservoir dam, and we brought forth to you for consideration is that along with the terminal reservoir dam, you know, the structural assessment that we did kind of indicating that there's potentially a seismic hazard component of that project, that we decided to also look at the terminal dam decommissioning. And so we're kind of, we are working on that, but the reason this particular one doesn't have a change is because we've kind of gone over in the direction right now towards the checking out what might be necessary to do the terminal dam decommissioning project. And I planned, if possible, I'm going to bring back something for sure at the November meeting to help us help you understand further what this project looks like as compared to, you know, looking at our keeping the terminal dam. So that will happen hopefully at the November meeting. And let's see. Basically, we've had no change on any of the items since July. Going forward on the second page, these are upcoming projects for 2021, and we're doing replacement of Hawk turbidimeters, upgrading the EQ pump, and our chlorine dioxide injection system, and the improved boat access. And we'll probably look at each of these. Something might drop off just based on the fact that I still do not have staff resources. I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to get David working back on our Zone 3 projects here coming up in November. So that's what I'm hoping. And completed projects, the repairs to the terminal dam spillway, that was some spalling of concrete that we noticed and we took care of it really didn't show up as a project, but it is something we did complete. And we also did completed the Lopez Terminal Dam Monument Survey, which is something that we actually do every year. And then the domestic tank repairs. So I don't have a lot of information on the, you know, nothing new as of yet. And we kind of discussed the why behind that on the when we discussed budget. And that's all I have. Does anybody have any questions? Anything they want more or less of?
Anyone? Okay, seeing none. We have no action items under item 7. So we'll then move along to item 8, action items that require Board of Supervisors action. So that'd be water supply contract changes, CEQA.
Yes. Dan Heimel from Water Systems Consulting, who has been helping me with the contract changes, just the coordination and the moving this effort forward. He's here tonight. We've been working on this jointly. So although this says that the staff report is from myself, it's really been a joint effort between he and I. And he is going to present, he has a presentation tonight to kind of help you understand where we are in this process and what the recommended action is tonight. Let's see. So Dan, I am going to make you the presenter, I think, if I can figure it out. All right, Dan, you should be the presenter.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, sir.
Can everybody see the presentation?
Check.
All yes. Right. Yes. Members of the, yeah, awesome. Members of the advisory committee, thank you for this opportunity to present an update and a request approval to move forward with the next steps for the Zone 3 contract changes. I think this is an exciting moment for this initiative. As Jill mentioned, there's me and her and a number of Zone 3 staff members have been working very diligently on this project since our last presentation to the advisory committee, which I believe was earlier this year, or late 2019. And we've, I think, reached a key and critical milestone to allow us to move this initiative forward. So with that, I'll jump into my presentation here. So, quickly, I just want to review the purpose. You know, why are we looking at Zone 3 contract changes? Then I'll provide a little bit of the background of where we've been to get to this point. And then the bulk of the presentation will focus on the proposed contract changes and the different elements of that. And then the CEQA process, which is really what we're looking for approval to move forward with tonight. And then finally, we'll wrap up with some next steps. So the purpose of changing the contracts, and many of you will likely recall, but it's always a good refresher when you're doing these multi-year initiatives, of why did you start this initiative in the first place? And so first, you know, one of the big drivers for this was to address the unintended consequences of the low reservoir response plan, whereas a number of agencies saved water in a storage account that the low reservoir response plan allowed, but then lost that water as we exited the low reservoir response plan because of the way the contracts are currently structured. And so it was a bit of a challenge. You know, agencies had worked hard to save water through conservation and utilization of the other water supply portfolios in an unprecedented drought, only to, because of the way the contracts are currently structured, lose access to that water. Now, granted, the water didn't go away. It stayed in the reservoir, but it was no longer credited to those agencies that worked very diligently to save that. So the purpose of the contract changes is to address that and to provide an you know, one of the most important things is to provide an enhanced ability for each of the agencies to store water for future droughts. It'll improve flexibility for multi-year water resource planning. It'll allow for enhanced water supply portfolio management. And then one of the biggest things is it provides an incentive for agencies to use their state water supplies and or preserve their Lopez supplies, so we retain a greater local water supply here in South San Luis Obispo County. Any questions about the purpose? Okay, moving on to the background. So as I described, there's a limited incentive to preserve Lopez water supplies, and that's because the current contracts have pretty limited ability for the agencies to retain or hold on to any unused Lopez water that they don't use within a given year or the subsequent year as surplus water. And then again, you know, agencies lost water during the LRRP, and that started this initiative. So the proposed contract changes would allow for agencies to store Lopez water as well as store state water. And it won't be actual physical state water, but water that would be classified as stored state water. And I'll get into that more later in the presentation. And then at our last presentation, or at least I should say my last presentation to the advisory committee, I'm sure Jill's been keeping you much more updated, but we showed some results of some modeling scenarios that we ran, looking at both how we think the reservoir would operate under the existing contracts and how we think it would operate under the proposed contract changes. And just as a refresher, two of the key findings from that modeling exercise was that under the proposed contract changes, we would anticipate more water would be retained within the reservoir because of the incentive to preserve Lopez supplies. And then the other finding was that even with the stored water, there would still be sufficient unentitled water or water that isn't designated for a specific Zone 3 agency to meet the downstream release requirements, which is obviously a very critical component of this, is the district's ability to meet its requirements for downstream releases under the IDRIS. And so the modeling showed that we would be able to do that over the entire hydrologic period, even with the contract changes in place. So a very key finding. This slide just shows a little bit of the process overview, kind of where we've been and where we're at. And so we started with developing conceptual contract amendments. You know, in concept, what do we want to do? We want the agencies to be able to store their unused water. Okay, that sounds simple in concept, but takes a while to translate that into detailed contractual language that, you know, can be agreed upon. And also, we need to understand the implications of those changes. And so, as I described earlier, we did reservoir modeling to look at those proposed amendments and see what potential changes those would have on the reservoir. And then we embarked into the contract modification effort. And this is really where we dug into the contract and made the specific, or at least proposed specific language edits that would be required to modify the contract to incorporate these conceptual storage concepts that we developed early on in the project. And I'd like to credit really the efforts. There was even a subcommittee of the TAC that was formed to really take this initiative on, and we had a number of meetings. Unfortunately, they were online, so it made them even more fun working through the contract changes. And the subcommittee members were myself and Jill, but really had a lot of extensive contributions from Will Clemens with the Oceana Community Services District, one of the advisory committee members, Brad Hageman with Avila Beach CSD, Shane Taylor with the City of Arroyo Grande, and Jim Gehring as representing any and everything Zone 3. So, and was that everybody, Jill or Brad? Just make sure. Hi. I didn't miss anybody.
Think so.
Yep, I think so too.
Okay. Yeah, and so there were a a number of meetings and we worked through a number of iterations, but ultimately came to what we feel like are a consensus agreed upon set of changes that will provide the requested modifications to the contract. And so that's where we're at. And where we're headed is the CEQA evaluation. So the California Environmental Quality Act requires us to do an evaluation of the potential impacts that the contract changes may have. And so one of the things in your agenda packet today is the project description, which is one of the very first steps of that CEQA evaluation for your review. And we'll talk about next steps later, but moving forward, we will be moving through CEQA, but also in parallel moving through the detailed, I would say even more detailed contract language amendments, review and negotiations. And I guess by more detail, I'd say we're gonna bring in the lawyers and see what they think about the changes and have them duke it out for a bit. But ultimately with the goal of developing an agreed upon set of changes that achieves the objectives of this project and allows us to move forward. So, and I guess I'll pause there and then I'll dig into the contract changes. Any questions to this point?
I have a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
At the very end of this contract, there is what is called the project. And it goes into a discussion about construction.
Yes, there's, Karen, that the project, so these contracts, that you kind of has to go back to when these contracts were rewritten. So they were, you know, they were first developed back in the, you know, 60s, mm-hmm. or late 60s as we got contractors. So we had probably, I don't know the date of the very first contracts, but after that they were amended in 1985. And then the big change, the big amendment to the contracts where we did another big rewrite was in 2000. And that was because we were embarking on this seismic remediation project.
Yes.
So a lot of language had to go into this about the loans and the bonds and how they were going to get paid. So the contracts had to describe what the project was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why at the back of the very end of the contract is this exhibit, which talks about the project and it being the seismic remediation.
With the project we are referring to here.
That's correct. We will likely have to leave that in the contracts because we are still paying off that our seismic, you know, the bonds from that seismic project. I believe the lawyers, you know, counsel, I think, is going to weigh in on that, on whether that actually needs to be in the contract still or, yeah, so okay. That's still up for grabs.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Great question. So here on this slide, we just have an overview of the key elements. Those of you that may have reviewed the red line or track changes contract component of your agenda packet, you'll see that there's a lot of different edits, but really, these are the key elements that we're looking to incorporate into the amended and restated contract, which we'll discuss here in a bit. But the changes are, you know, obviously to establish storage rights, but more specifically, storage rights for unused entitlement and surplus water for the Zone 3 agencies, as well as the ability to develop stored state water through in-lieu exchanges. So by using the term in-lieu, we don't mean actually putting state water in Lopez Reservoir, but we mean delivering state water in place of somebody's requested Lopez water, and then that generates stored water in the reservoir via an in-lieu mechanism. The other major provisions relate to the need, now that we're storing water in individual agency accounts, we need to account for evaporation And we also need to better track, or the district does a good job of tracking spills, but better track spills in the sense of we need to know whose water spilled over the reservoir in the lucky event that the reservoir spills up and spills again, which it will, but it just hasn't done it in a while. The other changes are just there were some modifications that we wanted to make to clarify delivery commitments and capacity limitations, just to make the language a little more clear than it was in the past and less open to different interpretations. And then there is also a good bit of, well, some of the language may feel outdated or antiquated, but it's still necessary, such as reference to the seismic retrofit project. There is other language that is outdated and that we can clean up and remove from the contract. So those are the main modifications. And then this is just a what I really kind of view as a roadmap, just a if you want to dig into the contract and see where the specific changes are related to these components, you know, like where were the modifications made to individual agency storage components, that's in these articles. If where are the stored state water components, that's in Article 7. This is just kind of a guide to help you if you want to look for certain components within the contract. And then the other thing, this is a good point to talk about the concept of amended and restated. So the Zone 3 TAC really had two options when making the changes. One was to make the changes as an amendment, and where we would just say attach a whole new section to the contract at the end that says change this section here and change this section here and change this section here. Or as what is being shown, amend and restate the contract, where we actually, the TAC went through and changed the elements of the contract within the contract itself. And so this it just is a way to go see where those changes were made.
I wanted to follow up a little bit on that. One of the driving forces for TAC to wish to do the amend and restate the contract is that you know, should this all go through, at the end of the day, you'll just have one document that you look at to refer to the contract. You won't have to have the old contract in front of you, find the section in front of the old contract, and then go, oh, is there an amendment to this section? I better go check. If you've ever looked at the state water contracts, they have it's a binder because they have the original contract and 16, you know, amendments, and each amendment is like, you know, 20, 30 pages. So it becomes not a very user-friendly document. So it's that's why we're going in the direction we are with amending and restating.
May I ask a question here? Could you just, I've read and reread agency initiated exchanges, and I think I understand it. I think about how I might try to explain that to my counsel, and then I've got myself all confused again. Could you just explain that to me kind of in layman's terms, kind of, sort of?
Well, Karen, actually, in a couple slides, I constantly am confused myself, and I'm sitting here working on this all the time. So as Dan and I were working on this presentation, we actually spent a fair amount of time on one of the slides here. So hold on. When we get through to that slide, we'll talk about it, and maybe we can give some better examples so you can kind of see how it works.
Terrific. Thank you.
This is Brian, and actually, maybe in the next slide you're going to get into it, is just about downstream release obligations. I don't see that, you know, an actual number stated in the contract, and I'm not sure that it ever was in the original contract. And Dan, I'm not sure if you want to address that now or if that's coming later.
Probably we could address that one now. The downstream release obligations weren't changed in any of the contract modifications, I believe. And Jill, is that, a correct statement. In reality, I think the downstream release obligations aren't described explicitly in the water supply contracts, other than the district's need to maintain them and the need to potentially reduce entitlements and other things to be able to meet those downstream release obligations. But downstream release obligations will still, if for the time being, be governed by the interim downstream release schedule, just as they are under the current contract. Jill?
Yeah, I remember we've looked at this. So what's interesting is the only place that 4,200 acre feet for downstream releases is discussed, where that number even shows up, is under Article 4D, which is surplus water. And I have it up here and I'll read it. It says, it talks about that surplus water is calculated for each water year by subtracting from the safe yield of the project. And that's defined in the contract that the safe yield is 8,700, an amount equal to the sum of the quantity of water released downstream during the immediately prior water year, which shall not exceed 4,200 acre feet unless legally required by Article 4A, which talks about environmental releases. So that's the only place that you're going to see the number 4,200, and we're not proposing to change that. If you look, if you have that contract open, it's page 16, and you can see that we have left the 4,200 acre feet there. What we are talking about as far as proposed contract provision is that once people start storing water, agencies are allowed to now store water. In order to take the what if scenario that there's no, let's just say, and I think you've brought this up before, Brian, that there is a situation in which, all the water in the reservoir is, stored water or, entitlement for another year. We put into the contract the order in which it'll be determined. Like once, if we don't have any water for downstream releases because it's all somebody else's water, we designated sort of the priority in which that water would be given. Like each agency would first have to, I think we said they'd have to give it up from their entitlement first, and then their surplus, and then their stored water. So it's possible that the agencies would have to give up some of their entitlement or stored water in order to ensure that whatever water for downstream releases is needed is met. But we did not change the 4,200 acre feet. Does that make sense?
Yes. I think it's more complicated than that. And, that's all I'm going to say right now, but thank you.
Okay. If you want to, we can discuss it offline if you wish. But yes, it is a complicated thought, or to imagine what that situation might be, but also leaving it open, for, understanding that the HCP is in the works is another consideration.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll move into just a little more detailed description of some of the core storage components. So the first one, we've talked about this, is the ability to store Lopez water. And what we mean by the ability to store Lopez water is the ability to store unused entitlement or surplus water by an individual agency. And that water that's stored would be subject to evaporative losses because now there's more water in the reservoir, the water level's higher, the surface area of the lake is higher, and there's more evaporation. And so we need to account for that and make sure that that comes out of the stored water. If the reservoir spills, there's the need to return the water in the reservoir to the district for future entitlements and downstream releases. And so stored water is the first water to spill. And then also, as we were just describing, there's a need to potentially make that water available for downstream releases if there's not enough what we're terming unentitled water in the reservoir to meet those obligations. And in that case, a water from the agency's stored account would be made available for downstream releases. So that's stored water. And that basically you generate stored water by, say, in a year, Arroyo Grande only uses half of its entitlement. And so the other half of its entitlement would be able to go into storage and would be called stored Lopez water. And then any surplus water that would be available to that agency at the time could also go into storage. So that's stored Lopez water. Now we transition to stored state water, and I'll admit it gets a little bit more complicated. So I'll do my best to walk through it. Jill will help me and hopefully we'll all come away with a consistent understanding. The first one is what we call district-initiated exchanges. And I think the key point here, and Jill did a good job of pointing this out, is this is really an operational flexibility addition to the contract. It's something that we're already doing that's just not, or the district is already doing, it's just not explicitly stated in the contract. So now we're putting it in the contract, so it's just better defined and we understand it. And so really what this is, it's the district's ability to take state water and provide it to the Zone 3 agencies during, one purpose of this, I should say, is to take state water and to provide it to the Zone 3 agencies, whether or not they're state water contractors, and we don't need to get into the whole they can take state water or not thing, when there's a Lopez plant shutdown. So, you know, there's an issue with the Lopez plant, the plant goes down, the district still wants to be able to provide water, so the district has access to state water through the Coastal Branch Pipeline, and it delivers that water down the Lopez pipeline. It tracks that water. And then when the Lopez plant comes back on, it then delivers Lopez water and enough Lopez water down the pipeline that it exchanges that state water that was delivered, and everything balances out to zero. And so this is intended to be a short-term exchange and really just done to provide some operational flexibility and some reliability benefits. So Zone 3 agencies that don't have state water can still get water in the event of a Lopez shutdown.
But I do want to point out one little thing is that we would not automatically, one thing that this builds in is that we would not automatically deliver water, deliver state water to another agency, to a non-state water agency, let's say Grover Beach, for example. Grover Beach would have to say, okay, we realize that the plant is shutting down because it has to do maintenance. We don't want to pay basically for state water. We're just going to use our groundwater for the next 3 weeks. And that's entirely their option. So that's that third bullet that says during a shutdown, a non-state water project agency would have to request to be delivered state water. And that and that would all be limited because if nobody is taking, if none of the state water project, none of the Lopez contractors who also have state water, if they are not taking any state water that year, and then the whole point is moot. We would not be able to do this. So it's limited to if for example, Pismo and Oceano are taking a bunch of state water, we can make this work. And the idea is it's short term. This would all go, as Dan said, everything balances out to zero. The water that we, the state water we delivered and versus the Lopez would all get balanced out in a year. We currently are not operating this way because it's not in the contracts, which is why we have 1,400 acre feet of state water. in the reservoir. And so over the next year, my goal is to kind of reverse that so that the district doesn't have all that state water stored behind the reservoir. But that's what the district initiated exchanges are all about.
And then, so then the second component or mechanism to utilize or store state water is agency initiated exchanges. And I'll read it here, but then I'll try to provide an example that hopefully helps clarify what this means. So these are exchanges by state water subcontractors. So that would provide state water to replace a requested delivery of Lopez water by another Zone 3 agency. And then that would allow that state water subcontractor to store or be credited stored state water in the reservoir. And so an example of this is, Karen was asking the question, so we'll use Grover Beach. Grover Beach says, we want 500 acre feet of Lopez water. And another organization with state water, so let's say Oceano, says, okay, we, Jill, they would request to Jill, the district, that they would like to bring in 500 additional acre feet of state water that they don't need and have it delivered down the Lopez pipeline and go to Grover Beach. And it, in exchange for that, they would get credit for the 500 acre feet of Lopez water that didn't come out of the reservoir because it came through the state water pipeline. And that water that they were credited in the reservoir would be classified as stored state water. So the difference between that and stored Lopez water, so stored Lopez water, let's use the same example, is Oceano says, Jill, I don't want any of my Lopez water. I don't want any of my 303 acre feet. I'm going to take all state water. And so at the end of the year, they don't take any of their 303 acre feet. And so that is unused entitlement, and it gets classified as stored Lopez water for in the Oceano example. So that we covered on the previous slide. In this slide, but that would be the max amount of water they could store within the reservoir in a given year without the agency-initiated exchange provision. With the agency-initiated exchange provision, they could bring in even more state water to fulfill the water requests of one of their Zone 3 partners and then get credit for that partner's unused water that was left in the reservoir because they got state water instead.
Makes perfect sense, right?
Clear as mud.
Jill, you want to take a crack at it?
No, I think you explained it really well. I like that example. I think the hard part is that it's accounting done on paper. And it's just hard to describe without showing you like a spreadsheet almost and go so that you could actually see how the numbers would be manipulated. The reason that this works, and you know, this is sort of a nuance, is that the district cannot sell state water to non-state water contractors, and that's the district can't do that. But once Oceano gets its water, it can do what it wants, which is why it can do this agency initiated exchange. The district can't do it, but Oceano and Pismo could. And so this does that.
I had a question for Dan about stored water. Can you explain that storage year after year? And are there limitations or how does that work?
Yeah, good question. And the subcommittee spent a good bit of time talking about limitations. So currently, the way the proposed contract changes are structured, the water can be stored year after year. So unused entitlement at the end of the Lopez water year, it becomes stored Lopez water for that agency. That agency could store that water for the entire next year. They would lose some of that water to evaporation. And if the reservoir spilled during that year, they would lose all or a portion of it to spill. But assuming those two things don't happen or there's still some water left, they can carry that water over for another year. And so it's year over year over year over year storage. You know, it is in essence the way it's currently structured. With respect to the question about storage limits, the decision was to structure the contracts in such a way that, you know, what we determined is that an agency storing water can store it until the point that it infringes on another agency's ability to store water. But that only occurs at what point that the reservoir starts spilling. And so there's mechanisms built into the contract to make sure that an agency that's storing more than its proportional share, its stored water spills first. But outside of that, there aren't storage limits because it was determined, or at least the consensus opinion of the group was that one agency storing a water doesn't infringe on another agency's rights, and therefore no storage limits were applied.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things about agency initiated exchanges. It is also that, and really stored state water is the term I used a lot for that, is it's also subject to evaporation losses as well as spills, and it spills before stored Lopez water spills. That was the order of priority that the agencies selected. And then the other component of it is stored state water, as currently structured, would not be available for downstream releases. And this was done and structured this way because the intent and the thought was that stored state water really represents not physical water, but additional water that was provided into the reservoir that would not have been there except because of the connection to the state water pipeline and the ability to deliver that water in lieu and of other Lopez water deliveries. So it's sort of viewed as, I don't like the term foreign water because it's not actually foreign water in the reservoir, but it's imported water that wouldn't have been there anyway, and so therefore wasn't subject to downstream release requirements. Any other questions before I move on? All right. So those are the contract changes. In your agenda packet is a red line version of the contract. And by red line, I mean it's the copy of the existing contract with the proposed changes shown as tracked edits, or track changes, I should say. Additionally included in there is what we're calling narrative comments or descriptions around each of the proposed edits, attempting or describing why those edits were made. So to help the reader not only be able to clearly see the change that's being made to the contract or the proposed change to the contract, but then also a comment bubble off to the side to sort of describe why that change was being made and how it would work. And that was really a great contribution from Jill, identifying that, you know, while we're showing them what the changes are, if we don't explain it, a lot of times it's very difficult to understand what the intent is. And so by providing those narrative comments, that the goal is that a reader can much better understand the proposed changes and the intent of them.
And they were helpful.
Oh, good.
So back to the process. Like we said at the beginning, you know, we're looking for a Zone 3 Advisory Committee recommendation to move forward with the CEQA process. And so the CEQA process is outlined here, and it's what's required to complete the environmental review. And so a couple of things have been done. One is to prepare the project description for the contract changes project for the as defined within CEQA. And so the project description attempts to, in more layman's terms, it's still relatively technical, but describe what the contract changes are and what effects they may have for the purposes of evaluating potential impacts of that under CEQA. And so County and Environmental and Keith Miller did a great job of listening to me and Jill and the subcommittee describe what was being done here and then writing up a project description for inclusion in the CEQA process. The other thing that's been done is the modeling analysis to compare the current contracts and operations under those current contracts with the operations under the potential changes. And so that work was done a while ago and was presented to the advisory committee back, and I'm trying to recall, it's late 2019, early 2020. So now moving forward, the steps for the CEQA process include, one, first, outreach to National Marine Fisheries Service about this upcoming CEQA evaluation for the contract changes. And really the intent there is we don't want to, you know, surprise the resource agencies. We want to give them a heads up that this is an initiative that the Zone 3 agencies in the district is working on, and they'll have the ability to review and comment. And so we want to, you know, sort of give them that courtesy, acknowledge that this is coming. And to my understanding, the district's recently engaged in a dialogue with National Marine Fisheries around other issues related to Lopez Reservoir and specifically HCP. So I think the timing's good in that, you know, there's currently an ongoing dialogue with that the resource agency. Following that, there will be the formal release of the notice of preparation and the project description, and that's really the first public step of the CEQA process. And then there will be a comment period in which the district will receive comments on the notice of preparation and the project description. Then after receiving those comments, the district environmental staff will prepare and release a mitigated negative declaration, a draft mitigated negative declaration, or MND, for another review and comment period. Upon receipt of those comments, the district environmental or the district will then respond to those comments. And then ultimately, the mitigated negative declaration would go to the Board of Supervisors for certification to complete the CEQA process.
Okay, so then are you looking for this committee to make a motion or just to us for us just to send a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors? Is that what you want us to do?
Yeah, Karen, let me go back. I'll tell you exactly what in the staff report, the first part I tried to, so we would be able to zone in on that or hone in on that.
Okay, go ahead.
Is that we're recommending that you guys make a motion to approve the district moving forward with preparing the CEQA evaluation for the project of changing the existing Zone 3 water supply contracts. That's basically what the action that we're looking for tonight. There's another slide in here where you will see the recommendation at the end of the presentation, but it's also the same one that's in the first paragraph of the staff report.
Very good. Thank you.
Hi, this is Shirley. I have a question on CEQA. Since these changes are basically in language, is the CEQA report as extensive as usual, or seems to me it shouldn't be that difficult?
I can provide a response. Julie, you can jump in if you want as well. We had a number of discussions with county environmental staff about this and legal counsel as well. And ultimately, it was decided that some form of CEQA evaluation was required, that this wouldn't qualify for an exemption. But that because it is not going to have, or not anticipated to have, significant impacts because it's an existing infrastructure. We're just looking to sort of change the way it's operated, or the framework with when it's operated, that likely it could qualify for a mitigated neg dec or a neg dec, but that wouldn't really require a full EIR. So yes and no.
Okay, thank you. That makes sense.
Okay, and then so the other process that'll be ongoing in parallel with the CEQA process, if approved to move forward, is the legal review process. And I misspoke a little bit earlier when I said, you know, we're going to bring the lawyers in. We've had legal counsel review the current proposed edits, both county legal counsel as well as some of the legal counsel from the Zone 3 agencies. And so they've done their preliminary review, and, you know, I think we've gotten positive feedback so far on the changes. But we're going to obviously have to embark on a much more detailed review as we move towards a step where each of the governing boards will be looking to execute the proposed contract changes. And so the next steps really are going to be the district and the Zone 3 Legals Council's more detailed review of the proposed changes. So that same document that was provided to the advisory committee will be routed around to the legal counsel representatives. And, you know, it's anticipated that there will need to be some changes and some tweaks to ultimately get to a final version that, you know, everybody can agree to. Once we get that to that point, then the next steps will be, and I think this is right, that each of the Zone 3 agencies would take this item to their governing board for approval. And then once approval by each of the Zone 3 agencies, it would go to the Board of Supervisors for execution, as well as taking action on the environmental document at that time. And so then, so that's the presentation. The recommendation, somebody jumping in with a question?
I was just going to ask if you could assign a timeline to those bullet points, and actually maybe only number five. When do you expect to have this completed, best case scenario?
Yeah, good question. I'm going to pull that up. What we're anticipating is that the CEQA component of this is going to be the critical path. And so I think based on where we are today with the draft project description and the number of steps we have ahead of us, I think it's a minimum 6 months to get to the point where we could certify the environmental document. And it could get extended, unfortunately. And I think one of the big factors is just the level of comment that we get from, you know, the resource and other potential responsible agencies around that. But that's sort of the overall schedule. I think we were looking at a 9-month approximately total schedule. We've done a couple of the first steps, but there still are a number of steps ahead of us, including some mandatory review and comment periods to work through.
Thank you. And since we're all looking at that picture right there, I will point out that that's a full reservoir, and maybe that's what it's going to look like after we all do a better job of storing water. Right, Dan?
Yeah. Good point.
I have to admit that was somewhat intentional. Yes. So I guess, yeah, Jill, is this the formal motion that we're requesting, or would we need the one from the staff report?
This is sort of an abbreviated. I probably would go forward with the one that's in the beginning of the staff report, just because it's a little bit more complete. But
okay.
Either way,
Jill, this is Kristen. So are you talking about the first paragraph under the recommendation? Can I go ahead and use that for my motion?
Yes. I think we have to have public comment, though, first.
Before. You're right.
So first of all, do we have, are there any more questions from this presentation? If there are no more questions, then I will call for public comment.
There's no public on my side.
I was going to say, the public just don't know what a good time we're having, or they'd be commenting on this.
I'm sure they would. Okay. So, seeing there is no public comment, if there are no more comments from this committee, then I would call for a motion.
This is Councilmember Barnage, and I move that the Zone 3 Advisory Committee approve the district moving forward with preparing the California Environmental Quality Act CEQA evaluation for the project of changing existing Zone 3 water supply contracts to allow the contractors to store water in the reservoir year over year.
Oceano seconds.
Very good. We have a motion and a second. May we have a roll call, please?
Yes. Member Bright?
Yes.
Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Member Gibson?
Yes.
Member Talley?
Yes.
And Member Hageman?
Yes.
And Member Barnage?
Yes.
All right, that's the motion passes.
Very good. Thank you. That was an excellent presentation. I appreciate all your hard work on that. It helped me immensely. I hope it did the rest of our committee, even though there's still so much there that it's hard for my brain to comprehend it all, but thank you very much. So we'll move on now to future agenda items, terminal dam decommissioning. I guess we're going to hear about that in November.
Yes, and you will likely see the capital improvement projects that will be proposed for the following fiscal year. That'd be fiscal year 21-22. We've currently entered budget season. So we're going to be developing that list of capital improvement projects for that fiscal year and bringing that kind of a draft list to you. I plan to take a draft first to the TAC at the beginning of November and make then, you know, based on their feedback, we'll tweak it, and then we will bring it to your group for a draft presentation on those projects. So that in January, you'll see the full budget, full draft budget, which will include not only the capital improvement projects, but labor and all the other, you know, parts and pieces of your budget. So that's what I have for November at this point. I am also, I can bring you a little bit of an update on cloud seeding at that point. You know, I believe that we are going to be successful in getting this other cloud seeding site that the city of AG looks like they're willing to work with us on, which is fantastic. Any other location is probably going to be problematic because we were unable to find any parcels that the district owned or that, you know, some other city agency were. We kind of looked at the Cold Canyon landfill, so we might attempt to approach them. But for right now, at least having the two sites is excellent. And as a point, I am going to, I think I mentioned this at our special meeting, that I have had an application by Matthew Scrudato to be a part of the, to take over Jim Gehring's a spot as member at large. And I plan to take that to the Board of Supervisors on October 20th. That's the only application I've received at this point. I'm hoping you will have a full committee by our November meeting.
So if we had other folks that maybe we wanted to bring forward.
Yes.
Should we have them
apply?
And how would we have them do that?
If you give them my contact information, I will send them the application.
Okay. So, because I, Ron Riley, I think maybe Jim Gehring may have passed his name to you, possibly.
What's his name?
Ron Riley.
Ron Riley. He mentioned that he had a couple people, but I never heard from them. So, okay. Yeah, send them my way.
I don't think he knew that he was supposed to do that. So I will forward that information on to him to contact you.
Perfect.
Okay, excellent. I guess that was my, I just went forward on to the committee member comments. So I just jumped the gun there. Are there any other committee member comments? No?
None for me.
Hearing none, then we'll adjourn this meeting.
Perfect. Meeting adjourned at exactly 8:30.
Very good. Thank you, everyone.
Well done, committee.
Bye-bye.
Good night. We'll see you in November. Oh.